Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It was the most promiscuous of my lifetime. I don't see shows with naked women running around, anymore. And you got to think you've probably got an audience of an average age in their early 20s. Guys in their early 20s tend to be horny 24 hours a day.
Because of this MTV spring break feeling in the air, there were some people who were disrespectful.
And you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we welcome our guests from comedy, TV, and film to dive into a documentary. And today's documentary is a very mixed-reviewed Woodstock 99, Love, Peace, and Rage, directed by Garrett Price, out now on HBO Max. Boomer nostalgia meets Gen X new metal in a fight where no one wins. The ceremonies took place in Rome, New York, in 1999, 30 years after the initial Woodstock Festival. Seemingly small logistics issues roll into a massive and literal shit show, sprinkled with arson, sexual assaults, and at least one fatality. Do Bill Simmons and HBO lay blame where it belongs, or are they re-exploiting these events for a quick payday more than two decades later? Here to discuss these questions and more are our guests, Corey Sklar, also known as Chalky, the Funk Wizard, a musician and comedic presence who has been a longtime friend of the show, and first-time guest, Adam Papagan, a comedian, public access producer, and candidate for California governor. Welcome to SupDoc, Corey and Adam. How's it going, guys?
It's going great. What's up? Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Hey, Woodstock. All right.
And you guys watch this together, I heard.
Yeah, we watch this together, so we're good guests for this.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'm not really a new metal guy, but I've been doing a little bit of a deep dive into the back catalog of Korn. And I gotta say, I kind of like Korn. Actually, this doc made me like Korn.
I hate Korn. I was around during this. I mean, we were all around during this time. But I'm older than Adam. I think I'm a little older than you, George. Maybe we're the same age.
No, I'm definitely older than you.
Okay. Well. Here's the thing about nu metal is what I've realized is like, if you were already into good music, then you weren't into nu metal. Mm-hmm. Like I wasn't into Korn or Slipknot or Limp Bizkit or Mudvayne or anything, because I already discovered the sick shit like Slayer and Bad Brains and mm-hmm. Like we already liked good stuff, so we didn't need that introduction yet.
I thought maybe you're gonna say as a bass player you detested the very flabby bass tone of Korn.
Of Fieldy, his name's Fieldy. Yeah, their bass player. Yeah.
I like how it sounds like just like a trampoline.
There's no notes. It's just clicks, right?
Yeah.
He has a solo album. It's called Basically, and it's like the Shags of bass playing.
Oh.
It's like all off time, and like the guy doesn't know how to play, and it's amazing. So all your listeners should go check out Basically Fieldies. But yeah, I was never a big nu metal guy, and Faith No More was it for me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I have no nostalgia for this time period at all. So, I mean, yeah. Do you, George? Do you, Adam?
I was actually the exact age of the MTV audience at the time. I watched the whole thing that weekend on MTV. Mm-hmm. This is 99. So I've been 11 going into sixth grade. Mm-hmm. So I liked all that music, but I had no reference point. All I knew was like my parents' music, which my parents aren't like, like big music heads or anything. So that was just what was fed to me is like, oh, this is what teenagers, which you are now, this is what we're supposed to like. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I thought it, you know, I just ate it all up as it was served to me. But I have no nostalgia now. There's nothing to rediscover. There's no reevaluation of it. It's a pretty shallow genre built on exploiting 11-year-olds, which I was at the time.
Now, Adam, like, did you also fall into that thing of having a feeling anti the boy bands at the same time, or feel like that was the anti-marketing of all the boy band stuff that was happening? Because they make a big deal out of that.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other side of it. But I wasn't like, man, I hate boy bands. I want to kick Justin Timberlake's ass. If I ever see him, he better run. You know, like, I got that there was the beef between the new metal and the boy band. I understood that the boy band stuff was not something I was supposed to like. You know, that was a bad, that was for girls, you know. But but I didn't like hate pop music. It was just, it was part of, you know, I will say something that the documentary did not cover, which I have always said about TRL in that time period, mm-hmm. is you really did have all different types of music. Yeah. You had rock, you had pop, you had R&B. Now, granted, none of that music has stood the test of time. Like, none of those. Christina Aguilera is kind of still around, but as a judge on a reality show, not as a musician, you know. Britney Spears has, you know, become iconic, but more for her troubled past than, you know, any of her music or anything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it really is not stood the test of time. But in the time period, that was the American bandstand of my generation. You really did get a little bit of it.
Your Carson Daly time period, the TRL mm-hmm. world. Yeah. I mean, I was aware of it, but not spending any time really in it. Very randomly, someone I went to college with was high school girlfriend of Carson Daly, and he played golf. That's all I remember gleaning from that.
So Cal guy came up on K-Rock 106.7, you know, that's where he came from.
And then there was a time he had a late night show on NBC, and then like,
he might still have it.
I think it's still on. Yeah. I think
it was like, there was like two weird crossovers. One was like maybe 2009. They filmed South by Southwest, and they filmed like the OCs. And I think like Carson Daly, like, sat in on drums with the OCs, if I'm remembering this correctly. Someone will correct me.
Who hasn't played drums for the OCs?
I have not.
George?
My old roommates have, but I have not. And then also the, I was going to say the other weird overlap of Carson Daly is like when I worked at Alternative Tentacles, they shot a segment on a mushroom growing operation that was in our same building. And like, I would just watch this one day. I'm just like, they couldn't come down the hall, talk to the record label. And they just wanted to film the mushroom business that was just growing mushrooms. And I'm like, oh, there were spores. There was like mushroom spores all over this warehouse where I worked in, where there was no ventilation. So that explains something. Yeah.
I don't think Carson wanted to interview Jello. Sorry.
No.
But I'm looking at the lineup for Woodstock 99, and they kind of skipped over this part of it. Because there's so many bands that played, so many.
Yeah.
And Adam is right. Like it's actually very eclectic. You have the jam band section, you have a lot of rap rock, you have a lot of, there's like a whole stage was like what was going on in Silver Lake at the time. Like there was Bijou Phillips, Beth Hart, all that stuff was happening. Jamiroquai played, you know, so Ben Lee, like there was a lot of stuff going on. And then there was the rave tent, there was the rock stuff. So it was eclectic. You can't take that away from it.
Yeah, this documentary only focuses on, I mean, like the festival opened with James Brown, and that like it was given like 20 seconds of time in the entire thing, and like so much time dedicated to Limp Bizkit in this thing. Not much ICP. I was actually surprised. I thought there'd be a little more given to ICP in this as well.
I don't think the Juggalo Army was a thing at this time. They were kind of a new band, but they used the money. This is the rumor that I've always heard. They used the money from Woodstock 99 to put on the first gathering of the Juggalos.
Oh, yeah. They were paid $500,000.
Yep, $500,000. Show. Can you believe that? Just Shaggy 2 Dope and Violent J got $250,000 each. That's insane.
In like 1999 money, which now I'm pretty sure that would be over $1 million. The film. Okay, so let's talk about the film in the sense that like this is the first in a series called like Music Box, which appears to be like It's produced by Bill Simmons. It's like a Ringer film. This is basically like one of the Ringer films. And I think there is maybe a connection to Ringer did a podcast series about Woodstock 99. And I believe that writer, Stephen Hayden, who is featured prominently in this, worked on that podcast. So
do you want to hear what else is coming down the pipeline on the Music Box series?
I saw some trailers, but yeah, go for it.
The next one is called Jagged, How Influential Jagged Little Pill Was. The next one after that is Untitled DMX Project. The one after that is called Listening to Kenny G, an examination of the most popular instrumentalist and why he's so polarizing. Next one's Mr. Saturday Night, Story of Robert Stigwood and How He Amped the Disco Era. I want to see that one. And then Untitled Juice WRLD Movie, a film exploring the late hip hop star. This sounds bad, but Woodstock 99 was a good one out the gate. This one, it sparked so much conversation. It's all anyone talked about for like 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think we're even at the tail end of the Woodstock 99 discourse, which is like it seemed like this is all based around stuff that came out in 2019 as like a reevaluation of this time period. There is a lot of tonal weird things about this. Like the very beginning, when you guys watch it, is there like a little intro from Garrett Price? Like there's a little interview segment, like him explaining like, well, we really had to like, I got that on HBO Max. It was like this weird little, like, it's not an apology, but it's just like this unnecessary additional explanation that maybe like made me wonder like what are they concerned about?
What was he saying in it?
It was just kind of like I wanted to make this a comedy, but so many terrible things happened. And like that basically was this like...
Maybe we had that on ours.
Yeah, okay, we did. Yeah, we did have that.
It was
okay,
very short, but also seemed unnecessary.
I definitely was not watching this movie because I was like, I didn't want to know the facts about Woodstock 99. What really happened that weekend? I don't care what anyone's opinion about Woodstock 99 is, to be honest with you. Like, it just happened. This was like, you know, the nostalgia, like I watched it on TV the first time and now I was watching the reevaluation on TV. That's how I looked at this. This was just a continuation of the MTV, what a shit show kind of narrative.
Yeah. As an 11-year-old, what was the vibe when you were watching this on the first time?
I definitely, so like building up to it, I knew I wasn't going to go to Woodstock 99, obviously. So like, I wasn't like, man, I wish I was there, but it was much like I approached the whole rap rock thing where I wasn't like stoked on it. I wasn't like, man, this looks so fun. It was just like, oh, this is the thing that's on MTV this weekend. So I guess we're going to be watching that and we're going to see what happens. And one thing I do remember from the original coverage on MTV is I remember that DMX was like, yeah, you know, if you focus, you could write two songs a day. And then the VJ was like, wow, that's really good work ethic. And then I had no gauge of like, is that a lot of songs to write in one day? Is that not very many? Like I had no reference point at all, but I remember very distinctly him saying writing two songs a day was like, you know, peak creative, your juices flowing, being able to churn out two raps a day in the studio.
I think that's very productive. I mean,
yeah, probably
at the lifespan of how much he accomplished in his life. Can't wait till Bill Simmons tells us all about DMX's life. Corey, what was your reaction to this film overall?
I liked it a lot. And I think the criticisms about it are valid, but I think they're also kind of weird. Like people are upset at the movie because the reactions of the promoters. And they're like, because the promoters kind of pass the buck and blame other things other than themselves. And if there's anybody to pin this on the disaster of Woodstock 99, it is these two men.
Yeah,
it is. I mean, they are. It's all their fault, really. It's 100% is. We could talk about the security guard, but they didn't hire security for fuck's sake. But like they kind of pass the buck of blame and still don't take any accountability. And people are upset about that and think it's a bad movie because of it. But like, that's the story. Like these guys are, that's how they're reacting. And that's good. And that's interesting. But like, I understand like how they try to push these narratives. There's one talking head, George. I don't remember. I don't know who the talking heads are specifically, and I don't know like music journalists really. Like I recognize John Rob Sheffield maybe,
but Dave Holmes.
Dave Holmes was great.
Yeah,
but like there's the one blonde woman who like really tries to push this.
She's a spin writer, I think. Yeah,
and she's trying to push all this modern like way of thought onto the onto the motivations of these kids, and it's just so off the mark. But it's off the mark in like a modern way, and I mean if they didn't include it, they would have got shat on even more, you know. So I liked the movie. I think it's a good movie, and there are definitely like some laugh out loud moments in this movie, and me and Adam were cracking up at some points, you know. I thought it was good. I liked it a lot.
I remember coming out of it feeling like weirdly shaken and not sure why. I mean, just the Lord of the Flies kind of aspect of it really did kind of affect me at the time. I didn't even really remember a lot of this stuff happening at the time it was happening. So like when I sort of saw how often people were just like getting assaulted, like, and like also the visceral, like the toilet situation was really visceral for me as well.
Let's talk about the toilet situation. That was a huge revelation to me, because I remember watching it on TV at the time and seeing people covered in mud and going like, oh, looks fun. They're covered in mud. And it wasn't mud. And people were rolling around in the shit water directly next to the porta potties. It's right next to you see the porta potties and the people, like, did they not realize it was shit, George?
I think some of them did not. I don't think you'd have to be pretty impaired. Like also everyone's dehydrated on top of everything, like to cover yourself in like actual feces. This is making me realize it's not that I dislike any particular genre of music. I don't think I could go to a festival of this size with bands that I love. Like, I just think I have a little bit of like an anxiety about being in a crowd like this. I mean, I'm trying to think of the last time I went to a big festival.
Unless you have an artist wristband, there's no point to attend a festival.
Yeah.
It's going to be miserable. You're not going to see like any great performances for all the bands. This is just a big payday.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fair weather fans. Yeah. No, it's not a good way to see music.
Yeah.
Objectively. Yeah. It's supposed to see a band as a house and then a small club, and it like goes up from there. And the bigger the venue, usually the worse the show is going to be.
And the more bands on the bill, the more a show sucks, just like in general, you know what I mean? But you know, Lollapalooza really like cracked this thing open as far as festival, like, oh wow, these could be really profitable. These eclectic festivals. I went to the second Lollapalooza in 94. It was dope. You know, I saw Nick Cave with L7.
The Boredoms did that one too, right?
They didn't come to LA. So Guided by Voices took the Boredoms place, which 14-year-old me saying Guided by Voices, I'm like, this is the most boring band I've ever seen. So Woodstock made sense at the time, but yeah, now it's just Coachella is just a mishmash of nothingness. I don't even think people that go to Coachella like music. You know what I mean?
And they really posit Coachella as the answer to this, which is you're right. There was like so many other festivals that existed. There was this thing called Gathering the Tribes, which also was kind of early Lollapalooza.
I went to the Tibetan Freedom concert, which was it was my first time in San Francisco.
Oh yeah, in Golden Gate Park or something like that. Yeah, with the Beastie
Boys. And now
Boys.
Tibet is free, thank God. You know, it
really worked out for them. Oh yeah, wait till Weigerfest. This film also does kind of follow the logic of the promoters. It really like kind of takes the argument of it goes along the lines of the argument of like, it's kind of Fred Durst's fault. And like, it does like in the end, like the promoters say, why were you willing to be interviewed again? These promoters is like, I'm wondering if I was one of these promoters, like, why would I be willing to go on mic and say,
it's because they all watch sports and they're like, oh, Bill Simmons is doing it. You know what I mean? You can get these old dudes on the shows.
That might be it. I mean, like even that guy, who co-founded it, Michael Lang, he didn't organize Altamont, but he's like, tied into Altamont. Like, he helped negotiate the moving the concert from Golden Gate Park.
Oh, so he has
Altamont.
A history of huge musical related disasters.
Yeah, already, like a year after Woodstock, that was Altamont. So it's, I feel like he's already kind of like done his time in like the destroying the legacy of Woodstock, like immediately after Woodstock.
Now, okay, they did this before. They did Woodstock 94. So yeah. there was a Woodstock 95. Okay, there was a Woodstock 94. Yeah. Do you remember that one, George?
Do not at all remember that. I mean, also like, I don't imagine anyone like lighting things on fire after the Cranberries, but you know, that is sort of buying into the argument that there's something so horrific about nu metal that like turns men into werewolves or something, which does seem like a bit of an overreach in this argument that they kind of weave throughout the documentary, that somehow, like, you know, I'm no big Anthony Kiedis fan, but I'm like, it's your fault for booking these people. I mean, like, basically it's like,
I don't think it's their fault for booking them. It's, I mean, the music, I don't think the music had anything to do with the violence and the sexual assault and the fires. I think it was bad planning. I mean, okay, break stuff probably added a little fuel to the fire, but literally, but like, no one is blaming the Red Hot Chili Peppers for actually playing the song Fire. They have more blame than Limp Bizkit, if you ask me. But it's 100% on the promoters with the infrastructure, the lack of water, the lack of security. So what did they do to hire security? What were they called? The Peace Patrol or something?
Peace Patrol, yeah.
The Get Along Gang, you know? That's not security. You need, like, security at these...
You need Hell's Angels in there.
Yeah, exactly. If you learn nothing from Altamont, yeah. Yeah, definitely add that in.
I wonder if that went into his thinking, actually. You know what I mean? He's like, oh, well, we can't get actual tough guys, but maybe that was, you know, that wow, interesting. I didn't realize he had something to do with Altamont.
Well, yeah, there's John Schur, who really comes off as the villain of this piece, for sure. Like, he basically blames women for being naked for the reason why people are grabbing them.
George, you've worked, you've done show promotion
and I have, yeah.
You've done shows on a smaller level, but like,
much smaller level.
I think to be a big time music promoter, you kind of have to be a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like being a high powered attorney or a politician or something.
I mean,
Sorry, Adam. I know you're running.
All right.
Adam's taught me this. He's blown this whole process open running for governor and showed me so much that, like, look, these politicians, they have to have this certain mindset. And I think, you know, like, if Bill Graham were alive today and he was being interviewed for something, he would be just the biggest piece of shit too. You know what I mean?
For sure. And even like, I was pointing out, even in the beginning of Summer of Soul, they kind of like talk about this guy being like, he had to lie to these people to give these other people to do the show. I'm like, yeah, that's concert promotion. That is what it is. You just a lot of lying and a lot of promises.
I mean, there was a lot of money put into this. I mean, how did they get so much money? Adam was saying when we were watching, he's like, oh, it must have been the TV rights.
The TV rights. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So much money.
They had pay-per-view and they had MTV. Mm-hmm. So think about this. MTV, and I don't know the exact numbers, but like, this is 3 days of solid programming for MTV. So potentially this is like 3 days of budget going just to one source, which is Woodstock 99. You know what I mean? Like, this is 3 solid days of programming that they're just spending on this. So yeah, it was the TV rights are, you know, because, like, I don't know what the pay-per-view cost, but there's infinitely more people can watch it on television, and the advertisers are going to want to get to those eyes versus who could physically attend it in Rome, New York, you know? So yeah, the TV money was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. It was just a lot of shady money stuff happening. If you really thought about it, they didn't get into this in the doc, but just like working small time shows, we all three of us could say, like, where's this money coming from? Okay, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, I mean, to pay all those artists, like, that's big money.
I mean, if ICP got a half mil, just think there's 32
acts. Think about how much
acts.
Los Lobos got.
This is definitely the biggest payday that probably any of these bands have ever gotten. Like, that's another thing they didn't focus on in the documentary is, like, this was the pinnacle of so many careers. Like, Everclear played this. Everclear played this show. They played like a 45-minute set. They're never like
They're playing for the AARP now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're playing county fairs. Like, they're never, ever going to be anywhere close to that level.
Yeah.
Also, too, in this era, there were a lot of these bands that had like a huge album that was like really heavily promoted and like pushed and had like 3-4 big singles. Mm-hmm. And then you never heard from the band again. They'd have a follow-up album that would just totally flop. And there were a lot of those bands played Woodstock 90.
Yeah, let me run through some of the bands real quick and see if any of them like catch your ear. Okay, there was a band called Oleander, who I remember seeing their CD. Mm-hmm. Mo Lit from Orange County.
Oh, yeah. Huge, huge, huge hit song with My Own Worst Enemy. And then again.
Buckcherry Live, Offspring, of course. We'll talk about them. Yeah, Bijou Phillips, Ben Lee, Beth Hart. That was like what was going on in Silver Lake at the time. Los Lobos. It's not a festival unless Los Lobos plays. Guster. Yeah, I remember that name, Everclear.
Oh, yeah, I think they're still around, yeah.
Tragically Hip. Only people in Canada know that band.
Yeah.
But they're very popular in Canada. Thank you, Can.
Two Skinny Jays. Does anyone remember that band? I do. Okay.
I do not.
The Gigolo Ants? What the hell is that?
They were kind of, they seemed like more like a college rock band, I thought.
Our Lady Peace, I remember that. Rusted Root.
Also.
And I'm doing like the littler bands that were just kind of faded away.
The bands from Toronto could just come down is maybe part of it. They could just cross.
Who are the Super Suckers? They played, aren't they? Like
crazy. The rock
Super
band.
Suckers played Woodstock 99?
Yeah.
Well, listen
they're kind
to
of
this.
Reverend Horton Heat level, as far as I know. Yeah.
This is very funny. On the third day, there's a stage called the Emerging Artist Stage where there's supposed to be like young artists playing, and John Entwistle played it.
Oh, yeah. Someone from the original Woodstock has to play. That's
another
right.
person from the original Woodstock that played was Robbie Krieger from The Doors, played with Creed.
That's
and
right.
He was wearing an Undertaker shirt and yellow pants.
And he had his laminate on. He had his laminate on stage.
Yeah. Have you seen the original Woodstock documentary? Because I have to admit, I've not actually watched the original Woodstock documentary.
Yeah, I have. I've seen it a lot. It's a good movie.
You think it's good? Yeah.
Guess what? There were way more deaths at the original Woodstock than there were at Woodstock 99. It wasn't that bad. It was
and births. I believe there were a few births. There were a few pregnancies that came to term during the brown acid moment.
It was actually probably way worse at the original Woodstock, like the shit in the bathroom situation, you know?
Well, okay, so let's get to the part that has to do with the physical infrastructure, which is like the tarmac. It was like, it was a former air base. So it was like a surface that just retains heat, and that was another factor. Like, I believe in the original Woodstock, it was like a mud field, which you would at least that would not retain and reflect heat back the way the pavement would at an airbase. But let's throw to a clip from the documentary. This is a clip from Woodstock 99.
In telling the story of Woodstock 99, it would have been really easy to structure this as a comedy, poking fun of all things late 1990s, the way people dressed, the music they listened to. But in reality, as that weekend unfolded, it played out much more like a horror film.
Moby comes off as a total dumbass. In almost
he's such a
everything
piece of
he's
shit.
In, almost everything. I mean, like his restaurant's okay. I like that he. I don't know if I like that he claims Flipper so hard, or it's just like another thing that he claims so hard.
He
to just try to prove like I like Mission of Burma and Flipper, and therefore
he always claims
I'm not
the void faith split too. He always talks about.
Yeah, so he's like the guy who's like I'm the dance music. I was the biggest dance music guy, but I'm a rock guy too, kind of.
Well,
Moby
really
is a poser, and this is how you know a poser is they call punk music, they call it punk rock. They say, well, I was into punk rock bands, and like no punk calls it that. It's just called punk. And punk, by the way, has been around for 40 years. Like, it's so not old. Progressive. It's like it's ingrained in the shopping malls and suburbs of America so deep. There's probably three generations of punks in Orange County at this point. So if you call it punk rock, you're a fucking poser.
I'm also seeing like a lot of like punk anti-vax stuff coming out. Have you been seeing that? There's it's kind of like the wellness community anti-vaxxing. There's punk anti-vaxxing. There's like any kind of contrarian. Like they just took the contrarian aspects of punk and literally that's all it is. It's just
I'm not going to take my medical advice from the guy from the Dwarves or anything. But yeah, Moby is really talk about revisionism. He's like, yeah, I just knew this wasn't the place to be. I knew this. I'm like, no, you fucking didn't, dude. You were all about it. This was your life. You were hitting on the girls. You were taking drugs. Like, fuck you, Moby. Stop trying to act like you're better than everyone. And also his restaurant is actually the worst restaurant I've ever been to in my life. Okay. They have this ahi tuna that they make out of watermelon and like, fuck that. Okay.
I went with my vegan sister. So like, I was like pleasantly surprised by some, like the polenta, but that also was like several years ago. I'm sure it's all kind of gone. He also seems like he semi like just clowned himself by like saying he dated Natalie Portman and like, A, you were like 15 years older than her and she was like, what, like 20 at the time? And she's like, that never even happened. So like just all bad all around.
He lies. He's a poser. He's a revisionist and he's a liar.
Not but even both, a vegan.
I went to his restaurant twice and he was there both times. I just want to say that. But yeah, he was a talking head. He was one of the performers they got that they were able to get in this movie. And they got some good ones. They got Scott from Creed, who's looking he's looking crazy. Jules looking amazing.
Yeah.
They got
Jonathan Davis from Coen.
Jonathan Davis, who looks great himself. Yeah. He looks really good. But they got the guy from The Roots, Tariq, who looks great. But I got to talk about The Offspring really quick because they look fucking crazy, dude.
right. When that came up and you showed them. Firstly, that one guy, I'm not a big Offspring guy, but
Noodles and Dexter.
Noodles was already much older than all of the rest of them in the 90s. He's kind of like the Billy Zoom in the
moment. He's the Mick Mars.
But you needed that, OC veteran punk.
They were funny. They were funny in the movie. And their set looked pretty sick, actually. Like, I never was a big Offspring fan. They kind of stink, but
That Americana, their album, that was the first CD I ever bought, besides Queen's Greatest Hits, which I had on cassette as a kid. Mm-hmm. But the first CD I ever owned was Americana Offspring. They were huge on TRL. They had a lot of these, let's call them what they are, novelty songs. Pretty Fly for a White Guy, that's like a novelty song, you know. So as an 11-year-old, I was like, oh, these guys are pretty cool. In 1999, the Offspring played... So I guess this would have been around the same time as Woodstock 99. They played Irvine Meadows, which is a big venue out here. Probably one of the bigger venues in Southern California. In 2010, I saw them play at the Irvine Meadows. And now they played there at the height of their career. Mm-hmm. I saw them play like when I was in college. They were still playing a huge ass venue 10 years after their peak, just based on the strength of those couple hits. Yeah, that's another thing I think that I really think that the documentary didn't focus on is like how big these bands actually were at the time, how many records they were, CDs they were selling. And then now they're these like nostalgia acts. And it's like, oh, Dexter, Noodles, what do they have to say, these old men or whatever? But like they were at the forefront of the music industry at this time period and are still popular enough to play these huge venues. And that show at the Irvine Meadows that I went to in 2010, that was the worst show I've ever been to in my life. Hands down. There's a part where like they wheel out a piano and Dexter does that. And it feels heaven is so far away. And he's like doing it on piano and he's like hitting like, it sounds like when Lurch plays the piano on like Adam's family. And it's like, this wasn't like they surprised him with the piano. Yeah. Like, hey, there's a piano here, Dexter, play. He chose to bring this piano on tour and he can't even fucking play it. Like, it was pathetic.
Oh, man. I haven't been to a festival in a while. The last festival I was at was FYF Fest in 2017. And I'm trying to remember, like, who was at that festival. Built to Spill. At every festival, somehow, like I'm seeing Built to Spill, Erykah Badu,
Blonde Redhead probably played.
I did see Blonde Redhead. Sleep played. Captain Jazz played. I of course was there.
That's sick.
Producer Nick will be jealous that I saw Captain Jazz twice in my life. He's probably seen them. Run the Jewels, Nine Inch Nails. We left during we left at the very end of Nine Inch Nails just to take public transit back home. But I that's the last time I've been to any kind of huge thing. And even then I was just like, this doesn't all make sense, but it kind of just makes sense as like LA people like this music. I guess that's like the commonality. It's just like, you know, that at least sort of had a tie in to it. It's not trying to be a generation defining event. And also they talk a little bit about how basically this whole thing is just like the shadow of the boomers continues to dominate everything, which I think is one takeaway. It's like, why even bother doing this? Because there is like so much name association with Woodstock that like every generation has to like compare themselves to Woodstock.
I think that was one of the narratives that was actually pretty on the mark, was mm-hmm. that like the audacity of the boomers. I think it's true. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, that was our whole lives was only good music is Jimi Hendrix and Rolling Stones. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that's basically what I was just bashed into our heads. And so I think that was a good point. I never thought of it before. I'm like, wait, yeah, why did we need another Woodstock? What the fuck? You know?
The boomers may have a point though on that, because it's like Jimi Hendrix is much better than Limp Bizkit.
I think we can
agree now that it's been, you know, a while, that the music of the 60s is objectively like the best music. It's like they were right. So, okay, what about this thesis in the movie? The death of Kurt Cobain cast such a dark shadow over culture that led directly to school shootings and misogyny and rape culture. Just the death of Kurt Cobain. It was so shocking. So shocking that this rock star died, that total, it just ruined the decade.
Total bullshit. It wasn't the way it was. Not at all. The death of Kurt Cobain had nothing to do with it. If Kurt Cobain would have stayed, would have been alive, I'm actually not sure if nu metal would have happened. I don't know. But we weren't thinking that. I was fully ensconced in the nu metal scene, even though I didn't like it, because I was in metal bands here in LA. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't playing like cool punk shows. I was like playing shitty shows on the Sunset Strip. And mm-hmm. every band there was Big Pants, White Guy with Dreads, rapper, DJ. And it sucked so bad. Static X. You know, all these bands. It just sucked. Hoobastank, it sucked so bad. So, but like, no one was thinking about Kurt Cobain.
The premise is like, it's like if Kurt Cobain, like, there was no way, like, the bands that Kurt Cobain championed would have been playing a festival of this size, because it just was not. If there was like basically like an All Tomorrow's Parties kind of thing, where it's like Kurt Cobain curates a show, it's like the Melvins, Daniel Johnston, Raincoats reunion, stuff like that. It's just not going to be bands that were like sort of, you know, drifting in the wake of grunge. I mean, I guess to say that like grunge was not like politically savvy as an overall thing on its own either. Whereas Rage Against the Machine was political. And they played this festival. Not much is talked about that. It's like you know, a very explicitly political band played this festival. So, like, a lot of the theses that have been thrown around here about, you know, like, there's something that is, like, culture was at its worst during this time is clearly not true, because culture has gotten worse since then. I feel like now culture is even worse than Woodstock 99.
Kid Rock gets political in this movie for a second, if you remember. God,
yes. We'll just have to play this quote. This is a classic quote from Kid Rock.
You know, a lot of times when white people have embraced hip hop, they've ignored the funk, they've ignored the R&B, you know, they've ignored the subtlety, and they've embraced homophobia and misogyny. If you don't like Kid Rock, you can suck my dick. The same thing with metal. There's a lot of wonderful, celebratory, joyful, fun metal, but somehow new metal embraced the troglodyte elements.
Now listen close. You want me to get political? Well, this is about as deep as Kid Rock thinks. Monica Lewinsky is a fucking hoe, and Bill Clinton is a goddamn pimp.
I'm granted, this is over 20 years ago, and I'm still so baffled, like, how it went from the sort of progressive, enlightened values of Kurt Cobain and Michael Stipe to misogyny and homophobia and the rape frat boy culture that was at Woodstock.
that being said, he's still in the political zeitgeist. You know, he's still, I mean, he's a full on Trumper, you know, he's still making news about it. So it maybe was a precursor to all this, you know?
Well, that's how things were, especially on MTV in 1990. What were the most popular things in 1999? South Park, toilet humor.
Yeah. Yes.
American Pie.
The Tom Matrix. Green. Was that
1982?
Yeah,
that was, maybe it was 2000.
Yeah.
But I mean, at least on MTV, it was very crude. It was very sexist. It was very like frat boy-esque. Look. And then the part of the story that always kind of gets taken out of this equation is this whole time that things were like that, the right was like, Hollywood is way too sexual. Hollywood is showing crazy violence to our kids. Like, Hollywood's kind of bad. And then 15 years down the line, you get Me Too, and everyone's just like, forgets that part, that there was like a lot of criticism about this era, about how it was over-sexualized, mm-hmm. and you know, how there were like nefarious actors pulling the strings in show business and stuff. And then the culture war just flips into the right goes, well, people are too sensitive. We like Hollywood now, you know, like whatever. It's culture war stuff, and it goes back and forth. But I think it is worth noting that, like, there was, you know, like people are like, yeah, Marilyn Manson, he's a bad person. Mm-hmm. And like, nah, it's freedom of speech. People can say whatever they want. And then it turns out like he actually is a bad person. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. You know, what do you know? But that was in the zeitgeist, and this sort of, certainly coming out of Hollywood, was this very like oversexed, like lesbian twins. I remember as like an 11-year-old, like that was just like pushed so much. It's like, these twins are going to les out with each other. That's like the hottest thing.
Tattoo?
And I'm like, yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, I guess lesbians are hot. Like, they're not hot, but like, I don't like, what? Like, why? Like, Girls Gone Wild was in the same era where.
Yeah, there was a few things that were thrown in here. Girls Gone Wild, and then like Monica Lewinsky. It's like, I don't know what points they're trying to make with those two things. Like just.
It was a horny time.
It was on VHS. It was on VHS. Like, people had to like order VHS tapes of Girls Going Wild, and now you don't have to do that. You don't need the VHS tape.
I remember the infomercials for Girls Gone Wild. Yes. I would watch those as like a 12-year-old.
Like, yeah, steel drums. Yeah. I only associate steel drums with that now in the back of my head. But speaking of sexism, this is like a weird choice in this film, which is they talk about how exploitative it is to have all these naked women on pay-per-view running around, and then they just keep showing it like over and over again. And like, it's like, it's really like trying to have it both ways. I think I have heard other criticisms of this documentary of like sort of like having it both ways-ism of like kind of like trying to, you know, play a couple of different arguments against each other and be like, I guess it's up to you at the end, even though it's squarely blaming the promoters. There's still a lot of like the filmmaking ethics of just like, you could talk about the fact that women were exploited without just perpetuating that. Also, you know, maybe some of those women, you know, they must have signed a release to just be on the premises of that whole place.
I don't think you signed a release. I think it's one of those things where there's signs posted up. Yeah. If you're here, but I think I understand the argument. I think it would be dumb of them not to have show the footage of all the mm-hmm. naked people. Like, you have it. It's just part what of happened. It.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the problem wasn't so much everyone getting naked. It was the entitlement of the men there just like touching and ripping mm-hmm. everyone's clothes off. That was the problem, you know?
Right.
And they don't have any footage of that.
Yeah. They don't have footage of that. So they just keep showing the same people like flashing the camera. Like it's Mardi Gras stuff.
One of the revelations to this movie that for me made it a really good documentary was the footage of the press conferences that they kept.
Oh yeah, those are great. Actually,
it was so good. Yeah. And so the journalists and the correspondents from MTV, for some reason, the two promoter dudes were actually holding press conferences daily throughout this shit show. I don't know why they were doing it, because it was a disaster.
Yeah.
And they were very confrontational with the people asking the questions. They were fighting with them. And it's very good. It's like very, very good footage. It's fascinating footage. And if for the only reason to watch this movie for that footage, I think is worth it.
It's like the hubris of the boomers to be like, we defined our generation. Now we'll define your generation, and we'll do it like in this very like, you know, shitty way. And
but these guys were driving off into a hotel after these press conferences while these kids were stuck there and it's covered in shit.
Yeah. No oversight.
I don't think everyone camped either. That was something that they kind of like, I know this would go against the point that they're trying to prove, but I would have loved somebody to have been like, yeah, we got a hotel, we brought our own water, and it was actually a pretty fun weekend. Like, you know, it's not like they're forced to camp there. Like, you could have gone home. You could have gone, you know, like, I don't know.
Adam's friend does a long-running Woodstock 99 podcast called Podcast 99. It's very good. Okay. And, yeah, they get people that were there sometimes, right, Adam? They're like, oh,
yeah, great survivors.
Weekend. Yeah, they get and they said, oh, yeah, it was fine. I saw some of my favorite bands, went home, it was great, you know? Yeah. Oh, well, there's a lot of those stories.
Yeah. I would think that if you were not there, if you dipped out before the very last day, you probably just avoided. I mean, if I went to any event and it ended with a huge like bonfire, I'd be kind of sketched out, you know, no matter who was playing. It could be like Godspeed You Black Emperor ends with like a bunch of people like setting buildings. Actually, that is probably what should happen after one of those shows. Yeah.
Oh, you know what they missed too? And I Adam brought this up when we were watching it. And I think it's such a good point is that like, I don't think the disaster would have been as big if it happened in California. I think it was a very East Coast mentality. It was a lot of Boston people there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. A mass hole riot. Is that
like, yeah. I mean, that it's a totally like, you know, over there it's Springsteen, it's Billy Joel. Over here it's Sublime. And like, you know what I mean? We're chill in California. Mm-hmm. Over there, those people are angry. Okay.
Yeah. Well, there's sort of like an argument about like just men are angry no matter what, right? Like that's kind of the other thing that kind of comes out of it. It's like these white men have all this privilege and they need something to be upset about. And then this bad quote from Moby about like nu metal is only taking like misogyny from like hip hop, which is like that's really insulting in the first place to say like that's like misogyny is like the domain of hip hop. And like another bad Mobyism. But yeah, like there's sort of like this idea that like, and then there's also this sort of like loose association to the January 6th riots. And, you know, like I don't think they're causal. I think there probably are some people that were at both. It just seems by nature there would be a few.
If we were to blame a band on January 6th, who would it be? Like Trace Atkins or something?
There's the hip hop movement. Are you familiar with the hip hop movement?
Hell yeah, I am. Adam makes me listen to pop country in his car, and it's
Adam, do you like this stuff?
Yeah, I do. I don't like every single one blindly, but yeah, I like the eclectic nature of the music, and I like how they're able to find a new way to like tell these like country stories and how. Yeah. No, I like it. I like the song craft, and I find it impressive that they can figure out a way to make a song that like Florida Georgia Line has a song where they're like, mixtapes got a little Hank, little Drake. And it's like, oh, Drake and Hank Williams are in this like new, and this is country. This is, you know, us coastal elites, you know, this is hick music. This is, you know, unenlightened stuff. And then here they are talking about actually having an eclectic and making new music that's actually relevant, like music on the radio that has at least some thing I can relate to. I don't know. I think that they've taken country in order to survive has had to take a little from rock, a little from hip hop, and it's a little from pop, and it's kind of and a little from country, obviously.
Right.
And it's kind of the only part of the music industry that's still like how the music industry has always been. And
I came across a couple of like very like very Trumpy hip hop artists that I think are maybe on the more indie spectrum of things. And the names are escaping me now, but like, I just like went down a rabbit hole. Like I found one and I found like five of them. And I was just like, wow, this is just a subgenre I was not familiar with. Maybe Florida Georgia Line I've heard of. They seem like a bit more mainstream than maybe some of these guys I'm thinking. They're like DistroKid, like Trumper, DistroKid MAGA hip hop.
Basically. Yeah, no, anything that's going to make it onto the radio in Los Angeles and the second biggest market in the country is going to be pretty inoffensive, pretty mainstream.
Yeah. Ozfest was also like around the Ozfest lineup.
That's a little after.
Kept going. That was a little bit after this. Yeah. But that's more nu metal-y But then like Neurosis was on
metal.
Those.
They also had real Neurosis, actual metal on Ozzfest.
Yeah.
I was like, fully checked out by the time Ozzfest was big. I was just like, I'm a cool kid and I only go to the smell and go see the Maishi and stuff.
Yeah.
And so in when Ozzfest, so a year after Woodstock 99, so this would have been the summer of 2000. So mm-hmm. You know, we were being raised on this diet of MTV, but now getting a little older. This is going into seventh grade now. And my friend from sixth grade was like, hey, my dad's going to get his concert tickets. We can go to Ozzfest or we can go to the Warped Tour. And I remember that being like a very like, okay, what kind of guy am I going to be? Am I going to be a metal guy or am I going to be a punk? Like, which one is it going to be? And I was like, we got to go to the Warped Tour. And then, yeah. You know, now here I am all these years later. So there you go.
I went to a Warped Tour once in 2000, I want to say three. And because my bandmate Vice Cooler really wanted to go, and then we had to come up with an excuse. So we just said like, I'm gonna write about it for the Alt Weekly in San Francisco, and I just like wrote about one of the side stage bands. But like it was, I got like heat stroked, and I saw Paris Hilton before I knew who she was. She was dating a guy from Sum 41, I believe at the time. That's it's a Canadian Charlotte, one, right? Yeah.
They're both Canadian?
Sum 41 is like a little guy with spiky blonde hair.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's Sum 41. Yeah. He was dating Paris Hilton. We saw her. I didn't know who she was. She gave me a real shitty look. Like, what are you doing talking to my man or whatever? Well, and I wasn't even talking to him.
It's interesting. Pop punks, it's still around. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's still very popular. So, I mean, someone's got to do a Bill Simmons got to do a documentary on the longevity of pop punk next.
Yeah, I mean,
man, a pop punk documentary.
Yeah,
I got to be in that.
Like HBO style. Come on, that'll be great. You know what I mean?
Yeah, the Rancid documentary for sure. There was like the Gilman documentary, or not the Gilman. There was also just an overall East Bay punk documentary.
There's an East Bay documentary. It made me realize that East Bay punk isn't that great.
Yeah, it's. It's just so much of my personal background is that Gilman world. It's just a subculture that I was. So like when I think of 1999, I'm like, what did I listen to in 1999? I'm like, Lauryn Hill came out in 1999. I was like going to see the Eiler set and like Lauryn Hill's album. And then like I don't think of the Matrix you know, one of the Wachowski movies. I'm like, I was really into Rushmore in 1999. So I think of that. That was my cultural, like Belle and Sebastian or something.
Yeah, I was listening to Belle and Sebastian. I think I was listening to like a lot of like Aphex Twin and like mm-hmm. Reflex Records and Warp Records stuff. I think I was like, I'm done with guitars in that year, just that specific year. Then I got back into guitars the next year.
Yeah. I think that was the first year I heard, or maybe the second year I heard Lightning Bolt's first record. And I was just like, I like this thing that sounds like it was recorded inside of a blender. Like the microphone was in the blender while it was going on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, like Lauryn Hill's album was huge. So I don't know. Like I don't have a lot of nostalgia for the bands from this period. I don't particularly even like Jewel or Alanis Morissette very much. It was shocking that there were only three women booked on an entire 3-day festival, though. That seems indicative of something. But I don't know that like having more women, would that have made less rioting happen? That's kind of the argument that's embedded inside of this.
John Tafford, Corey's good friend, John Tafford, from Bar Rescue says that if you have a bar where there's a lot of fights, you should play a female artist like every three songs because it chills everybody out.
Huh.
So if there had been more female artists, there definitely would not have been as much rioting and sexual assault. I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. So the Cranberries should have come back. They should have brought the Cranberries back.
It doesn't matter though. It's a futile argument because I mean everything was dictated by the record companies at this time. Mm-hmm. If Kurt Cobain died or not, they saw where the money was. Like, I mean, that's why Kurt Cobain got huge, because they saw that there was money there. So they pushed this stuff. And then there was a million shitty grunge bands. And then who was the first new metal band to get really big? Was it
Rage Against the Machine? We talked about this when we were watching it. It was Rage Against the Machine.
That's crazy because everything that had like there wasn't a million bands that sounded like Rage after Rage. It all sounded like shit. So, but I guess I mean, that's
Rage Against the Machine has a virtuoso guitar player. Like, you can't just get a really good guitar player in your band, especially if you're from, where's Limp Bizkit from? Gainesville. Like,
what
you're
not going
to have access to the talent that like Rage Against the Machine has in Los Angeles. You know,
West Borland is a sick guitar player. So
he looks cool, but he's not a good guitar player.
Have you noticed this, George? Have you noticed that, like, for some reason right now, there's like a resurgence, like, there's a critical reevaluation of Limp Bizkit themselves. Like, this,
I saw on Twitter or something. I thought it was tied into this doc though. Possibly.
This came out like right at the time where Fred Durst, that he just played a show and he dressed funny and everyone's like, oh, look how funny he dressed. We love Fred Durst. Like, I don't know. People are loving Limp Bizkit right now. And it's weird. I think it's just, this timing with this doc happened, but like, they suck, right? They've always sucked,
yeah,
right?
The lyrics are very bad. I mean, it's laughable how bad the lyrics of Limp Bizkit are, to the point where I'm like, oh, I like the Korn lyrics. I think if you put Korn against Limp Bizkit, Korn is definitely a better musical act. I don't know if you would agree with that.
I mean, they have less riffs, but they're more of a singular sound, I'd say. But let's get down to it, George. Is Limp Bizkit at fault for anything in this at this Woodstock 99 debacle? Did they do anything wrong?
Was it during their set that people started tearing down the wooden, like, and then people were like surfing on the wooden
planks?
There's
so much great footage of like fat, chubby white teens surfing on wooden planks. And they have no hair on their body and they have no tattoos and they're just like pale. And it's amazing. Incredible footage.
I think only one person dying that they talk about is like pretty good. Like, how many people died during this whole thing, considering how much
the only confirmed death? It's only that guy.
And it was like a dehydration.
Yeah. And he died during the pit. He died in Metallica. The pit for Metallica, which is how he wanted to die.
Yeah. That's
how he wanted to die. I think he wanted to see Metallica. That was the goal ended.
He died doing what
he
did.
I hope I die.
Journaling. I also have to say, when they start just reading his journals, I'm like, this guy's dead. Like, half an hour in, I'm like, why are they reading his journals? This guy died for sure. It's definitely
did you like that? Did you like that through line in the documentary?
I did. It's sad watching his friend cry, like talking about, like, you know, he was a simple guy who just wanted to see Metallica and then he did. And then he didn't drink enough water because it was too expensive. The water was too expensive.
His diaries were very, very good documentation of what happened during that weekend, though. It was very good. He's like, yeah, there's a lot of dumb guys here. A lot of guys just yelling for tits. The water's expensive. There's shit everywhere. Like, I don't know. What's a famous documentarian in history? Anyway.
A Ken Burns letter.
Woodstock
99's. It should have been the Ken Burns pan slow zoom.
I think his texts are very important to the story. So I'm glad they included it.
I think that this felt like 2 hours was a little long, even though this was like, they had so much footage to work with. It did feel like, if you took out a lot of the cultural commentary contextualization stuff, they had a lot of talking heads doing this contextualization. I think it would have been, you could have cut a half hour out of this thing. And some of it, I don't think was necessary.
This would have worked just as well as an episode of Behind the Music. Like, if they had just given it the Behind the Music 3-4 minute treatment, like, it would have been, nobody would be talking about it. It wouldn't be lauded, but it would have been the same story.
Yeah, I don't know if many people have been lauding this, but it's definitely like, it's brought up a lot of issues for a lot of people.
I think that's a marker of success is if people are talking about it, if they're, you know, if it gets you your documentary deal where you get to make 5 more of these about every other stupid subject.
Yeah, the guy.
I'd be like, why does Bill Simmons get to like tell me about music? You want me to make a documentary about sports? Like,
yeah, I was gonna say
something I don't know shit about. Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, people love the 30 for 30s, but just like Netflix already tried to kind of do a 30 for 30 about music, which is the This Is Pop series, which are like definitely like more superficial. I mean, this is like I don't know if I agree with a lot of the stuff that's been said in this thing, but I guess it's not superficial. Like, it definitely like is a, it's a, it's a deeply, they have a lot of archival footage to work with. So, but I do feel like I don't have a sense of, you know, my sense of like what it was probably like to be there is I would be hot and I would probably just want to leave. That would be my sense of it.
And you'd also be like, yo, all this music sucks.
I mean, I would be like, I legitimately thought the 2 minutes of Korn that were shown were like, I probably would have liked this if I was just a little younger. I mean, I did kind of like am okay with it now. I don't think they played this thing.
Yeah, okay.
But like, so. I would definitely be excited to see Nine Inch Nails. I feel like my interest in these bands, I just wasn't interested in these bands at the time for the most part. And, you know, I don't think anyone, like off that list that you read, like, I don't even think I like Ben Lee anymore. Ben Lee is like selling essential oils. Yeah. He's like a MLM guy. So I don't know. I'm the 90s.
Everclear might be the best band that came out of this whole thing.
I mean, the Chili Peppers are this weird thing that just never goes away. The Chili Peppers will always kind of like, they're going to be touring forever. They're going to be cryogenic.
We're from SoCal.
Heads.
We have to like them.
I'm not from SoCal. So
they're dope.
Yeah. I was thinking about like the bands that were my 90s bands. Like it was a big deal when like Jawbreaker was like on a major label. So it's like I was definitely not paying attention to a lot of this stuff when it was happening, or really that much MTV. I think I'm just dating myself by talking about it like this, but definitely I did a lot of concert promotion. I never really thought about all the damage that could be done. Really had a huge reevaluation of a lot of this stuff after Ghost Ship. Even I was just like, damn, I really wasn't thinking about what could go wrong. And like, I think it's important for some adults in these situations to be thinking about that. And it wasn't the guys that were like 30 years older than everyone else. They actually didn't do much planning at all. They just were, their main concern was not having all these people sneak in like they did in 94. And that's basically why they moved into this Air Force base. So they could control it better. And it was to go back to, it was about the money. Everyone was mad that it was like they're being taken advantage of. They had $4 waters. They had no good facilities. It was like a mini rebellion, but that they elected to be in. I mean, the other things this is very similar to, Fyre Festival documentary, which, you know.
Which one?
I would say this is more like the Netflix Christmas one, I think. Okay. But yeah, like it this doesn't even take.
That's the suck dick for water one, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Andy sucking dick for water. Yeah, like we could have used Andy in Woodstock 99. It just makes me afraid of people again. I don't know. I was just like just getting back in the idea, like I can be around people. And then this comes out. I'm like, nah, people are bad. People are bad. Huge gatherings of people, inherently bad. That's what I come down to.
Yeah, agree. 100%. And actually, right after this recording, I'm going to go meet Adam at a free concert in a park, and we'll let you know how the bathroom situation is.
But that's going to be like...
And if any lessons were
that's
learned...
That's going to be a police state, though.
That's going to be like SoundCloud-level yeah. people, though, not MTV-level people, not Viacom. There's no Viacom pay-per-view at the MacArthur Park where you guys are going, so... I'm just trying not to catch COVID to go see like a band I like.
Oh, was there a scene where the mayor of New York comes and says hi to everybody?
Mayor of Rome. Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, right. I love it's kind of like the Olympics. Like they thought that they would be making money for the city and it just cost the city money.
Mm-hmm. So Summer of Soul also has a scene where the mayor comes and says hi to everybody.
Yeah.
So right, that's right. Like a thing festivals have to do. The mayor has to come and say, I wonder if Eric Garcetti is going to come and say hi to us today.
Tonight. Yeah, maybe Garcetti. But I was going to say, I think he's out pretty soon. Speaking of politicians being out pretty soon, Adam, what do you want to say about your run for governor?
Well, you know, if you've enjoyed my banter here on the show today about, you know, music, and you think that maybe you're like, oh, that guy's kind of relatable. Like, maybe he wouldn't be such a bad governor. Take it one step further. Like, why do we let these like robot, like lame, opportunist, elitist, rich people, why are they the only ones who are qualified to run for government? And we just sort of just accept that that's the fact. Like, we need more people like us in government. And that's the whole point of my campaign. So if you live in California and you haven't cast your ballot yet in the recall election, vote for me if you want. Like, I'm not going to win. Like, I don't care, whatever you want to do. But, you know, like, I support the recall because I think Gavin Newsom is a lame rich guy who doesn't care about us. And, you know, vote for me is what I'm trying to say.
Let's just remind people when the election is. Even if you don't vote for Adam, you should be aware of when this recall election is happening.
September 14th, but they're mailing ballots to people now.
Okay.
That kind of backfired on the Democrats, the voting access thing. When something comes that they don't want people to vote for, because Newsom is telling people not to vote.
So oh my God.
It's not as far as voter suppression. He's like out there, like the governor of California is like, yeah, vote no on the recall and leave the second part blank. Don't vote for any candidates. It's like, I don't know. That's like a lame, it's a slippery slope and it's lame and like both sides are bad.
Both sides are bad. I don't want Gavin Newsom, not my favorite. I lived in San Francisco, you know, in the last two decades, but you know, I used to call him like shitty Batman, shitty Christian Bale Batman, and then Jerry Brown is sort of like Dark Knight. That's how I view those guys. But check out Adam's websites. Adam, this is your first podcast? You've been on some podcasts?
I've been on many podcasts.
Man, I thought I was breaking some new ground here. Adam Pop again, first time on SupDoc. Glad to have you. You're welcome back. Corey, what do you got to plug?
Nothing.
You're doing talkies in October.
October 20th, talkies. Yeah, I'm in San Francisco and vote for Adam. Yeah. You could vote no on the recall, but still vote for Adam.
That's right. You can do both.
That's a good compromise. Mm-hmm. Definitely don't vote for Christian Bale Batman. Guys, I'm going to go listen to some Korn. I'm going to add some backwards R's to my name on Twitter handle. So that'll be my tribute.
Oh, you should start this podcast with the "Are you ready?" from Korn.
I just want to start doing, I want an a cappella version of the SupDoc theme song in the style of Korn, like a boom, bam, boom, 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 kind of the scat. I like there's a little scat in there. Guys, I'm turning it. I don't know what's happening to me. Also, like, this also reminded me, this is also the prequel to Memorial Day 2000. I forgot to mention that this is very much the prequel to, Corey was on our Memorial Day 2000 episode. All like the
great,
all
great
the elite. I realized what an elitist hand wringer, pearl clutcher I was during Memorial Day 2000. And now I'm coming around to be like, I kind of think Korn's okay when I'm watching. I'm like, it's not their fault that there was assaults. Okay, guys, that's not a good way to end, but I don't know what else to do because we've hit our time limit. Thank you, Corey. Check out Chalky on Twitter. Adam Papagen, vote no on the recall. Yes for Papagen.
Well, I think you should vote yes on the recall personally because
it's my show, Adam. It's my show.
All right. Okay.
Viacom of this show.
All right.
If you want to help, why don't you get over here? You can help monitor all this stuff.
Also, if anyone needs to watch this doc, just hit me up. I'll give you my HBO Max login.
That's worth that. You can watch Suicide Squad on Corey Sklar's login, and we'll talk about King Shark next time. Another valid documentary topic. Thanks so much, guys, for being on SupDoc.
Thanks, George.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com, recapping reality since 2015. Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show was engineered by Will Scoville. Our associate producer is Nick Kulsis. Please donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help us in other ways, please share the show with a friend. Join the Doc Talk and check out our hot takes, pictures, and videos on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. We're SupDoc Podcast on all of those platforms. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. You can find Paco and George's comedy gigs when those are happening again on the About Us page on the site. And SupDoc is by Doc fans for Doc fans. So if you want to advertise, got a film, or opinions you want to share, just hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.